Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rory. Jack Spencer, join us here in a little bit. We've got a jam-packed episode today, but before we jump into our first interview of the day, John, I wanted to talk about last week's Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference. And the reason why I wanted to mention it is because the economy, according to the economists at the Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference and the business presentation that you were at earlier this week, indicated the economy should be doing okay this year.
In a lot of ways, the economy for 2020 is going to be a little bit better than it was for 2019, assuming a couple of things. Remember, we had that 40-day UAW General Motors strike in the fall that caused some uncertainty. And in May last year, when they had the Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference, they were really down on the economy. They thought we were going to have a downturn, that we were going to start entering sort of recession waters, if you were. But a lot of those things cleared up. The strike's been resolved. A lot of the issues that they were concerned about have kind of resolved themselves in terms of the monetary policy and where everything is. And consumer spending has stayed robust. So I think one of the economists said the chances of having a recession in 2020 are near zero.
Isn't that interesting, too, going into the year? Because we kept hearing that we're getting close to the cliff and we're going to hit a recession at some point. It's just the way the cyclical economy works, and maybe not the case. And so you would think then, if the economy's doing well, we should be flush with dollars, that lawmakers should be excited that they can go to the table and start spending some more money. And while we're starting to get signs from the Republican legislature that, yeah, we kind of like to do that, the governor is of a different mindset.
Well, it was interesting. One of the questions I asked right out of the gate for the budget director and the treasurer at the end of the Consensus Revenue Spending Conference was, what exactly is available for a supplemental early this year? And they didn't want to give me a number.
Of course they don't.
One after the other. And they kind of get, there's a lot of pressure on the budget. There's a lot of pressure on the budget. And they wouldn't give me a number. I worked with Chris Harkins over at the Senate Fiscal Agency. We came up with the number, his agency came up with a number of, I think it was $879 million available when you combine school aid fund and general fund. So there is money there. But apparently the administration doesn't really want to talk about a big number like that. Maybe there's a little bit of concern there'd be a stampede and it would limit their ability to move or maneuver for the next budget year.
Well, because remember that 2015 roads package that was signed, they were ramping up general fund contributions to the road, and we're going to finally hit that last peak, that $300 million additional going to the roads. And then also we're going to be doing that homestead exemption that Mikoff added into that roads package as well. So that's $500 million right there of additional pressure that we weren't expecting otherwise.
This is true. So
then on top of the practical nature of this, we also have the political. And if the economy is doing well, that takes off a subject pretty much off the plate then for Democrats going into 2020. Trump could actually come into Michigan and say, hey, the economy's great, everything's fine.
Well, and as a matter of fact, following the Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference, I think it was the Republican National Committee issued a press release into the state saying, Michigan's doing great. Economists say Michigan is doing well. Thank you, Mr. Trump, right?
Yeah. So, and you can't miss an opportunity like that, right?
Absolutely not.
All right, well, let's bring in our first guest here, the former Speaker of the House, Jace Bulger.
2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road.
Join us here in MERS World Headquarters is the former Speaker of the House, Jace Bulger. Thanks for making it over here again. Always glad to see you.
Well, it's always impressive to be at MERS World Headquarters.
I know. It is an impressive thing. Let's talk a little bit about roads, because in the first few months of this legislative session in 2020, we expect that to be the big issue. You dealt with that as the House Speaker. And how would you say your Republican House did with the roads? Because when you left office, there was still this funding deficit with the roads, and some might argue you didn't do anything as Speaker when it came to the roads.
Yeah, it's yet another session starting with the discussion on roads, right? And I'll start off saying, you know, it's a regret that we didn't find a solution, that we didn't reach agreement on a solution when I was in office. Maybe I ought to embrace, so there seems to be an accepted narrative that we blocked or I blocked a tax increase, and maybe I ought to embrace that. That would be good politically, saying that you single-handedly blocked a tax increase. But that's not the truth. And so what I worry about is that doesn't learn the lessons of the past. And so when I say that, I think there were two main lessons that I saw. Number one, where we ended up. So that what everybody's aware of, we ended up with a ballot proposal that sought to do too much. Ironically, after that went down in flames, went down 80-20, a public was asked in a poll, what would you support to fix the roads? And of all the options presented, there's only one that got over 50%. And
that
was
a sales tax.
So 1% sales tax, what they had just put down in flames. But the question was if it all went to roads. And so the lesson learned is don't seek to do too much. And there was discussion when that was crafted that we needed to have something for everybody. There needed to be something for schools. There needed to be something for locals. The money needed to go everywhere so that everybody would be happy. What it ended up was there was something for everyone to hate in the proposal. And so the voters looked at it and said, it's not all going to fix the roads. It's going to a bunch of other things. So they tanked it. So I think that's important. You fix the problems and you can have a so-called grand bargain. But even in the Detroit grand bargain, they were all related to the issues at hand. So fix the issues at hand. The other is you got to recognize what people are saying or what's important to them and then compromise within that. Not reported much at the time. You can find some references to it. And maybe I didn't do a good job explaining what we were willing to do is effectively if the House was at zero and the governor and the Senate were at $1.2 billion, that was the number at the time. Obviously, it begs the question, well, where in between those two are you going to meet? And what we didn't maybe publicly say very well at the time was we had agreed to do $1.2 billion. The question was, how much new revenue were you going to raise? So what did we do, Kyle? We dedicated some existing resources to roads. It was about $400 million a year. What did we privately agree to do in those negotiations? Add $800 million to that, so long as we kept that $400 million dedication. And so you would have got to 1.2.
But you didn't raise money, though. You were just reallocating money within the existing budget, right?
The $400 million, what we had privately agreed to was to find a way to raise the $800 million.
Oh, with Snyder.
Yes. And that's the negotiation that broke down, that got very close, that really ultimately, I think, fell to miscommunication. The sales tax proposal was born. And then once that train left the station, we didn't turn around when maybe we should have.
That proposal that went in front of voters was too complicated. Was there a part of it, though, where the people, the public, the voting public just doesn't trust what comes out of Lansing anymore?
I think there's a lot to be said for that. And it was true in this when they said, you hear about the lottery. All the lottery money goes to schools, but people don't believe it was additive to schools. If they think either it didn't go there, number one, or if they're maybe a little bit more attuned, they say, well, maybe it went there, but they took other money away from the schools. And so it didn't add to the schools. And so I think there's that general distrust. But then within this proposal, it was clear that it did all sorts of other things as well, include sending money to schools and local governments. So it did more than just seeking to fix the roads. And so it was extra vulnerable to that perception.
So let's take those lessons learned to 2020. And one of the proposals that we're hearing about now is this idea of finding additional bonding options for the roads. Is that something that would make some sense?
No.
No,
in 500 words or less, no. You don't add more debt to the problem. So I think the first thing they have to do is...
So is a tax increase better than bonding?
If forced with those two, yes. A user-based fee would be better policy than just bonding or kicking that on to future generations to pay for.
You said forced to choose between the two, but you drive on the roads. Yeah. Is doing nothing an option, I mean, in your opinion?
I don't think it's an option. I think what they need to do, though, at first is agree to the amount of money that needs to go to the roads and then debate how are they going to get that money to roads. So, again, if I go back to 2014, 1.2 was the number. Then the question was how much existing and how much new. That conversation is very much the same. Now, in 2014, it was rejected to do 400 existing, 800 new. Effectively, what they compromised on in 15 was ultimately 800 existing, 400 new. Now, it was sold as 600 at the time, but it included a $200 million property tax credit. So it rolled back $200 million worth of revenue. So ultimately it cost $800 million of existing and only added $400 million in new revenue. But the point is, before they're going to get anywhere, they have to agree on the number they're going to reach and then they have to seek to only do things that solve that problem. So if they make a shift on sales tax from the pump, they have to decide how are they going to fill that void. If they look to raise new revenue, how are they going to raise the new revenue? But it becomes more manageable when you keep it inside the box of the problem you're trying to solve. Policy Forum has had ideas on how you could backfill through cash flow for that school aid fund. If you shift the sales tax at the pump, that could fix a problem at hand within that broader package and would be very different than bonding for new money. But the point is they've got to really break it down into the key essentials, the key pieces of the problems they're seeking to resolve, and then negotiate within that how they're going to solve those problems.
Is a ballot proposal, a second ballot proposal, then an option? You mentioned that the complex one from 2014 didn't end up working, but let's say you do something a bit more simple. Let's say just a penny more for the sales tax. And if you don't like that, we can just raise the gas taxes.
I think the public would still be very doubtful that it's going to be as clear as they put forward. And if you start saying, or we'll do this, or we'll do it, starts to get pretty complex.
Yeah, but right it can be away. A proposal A style thing. You know, you can already pass the gas tax and you can argue to voters if you want to scale back the gas tax, vote yes, and we'll just pay you with, or we'll just hit you with another penny on the sales tax.
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who wouldn't want it to go to the ballot again. The public would be very suspicious of it, very doubtful of it. I'm not saying it would be ultimately bad policy because this is what we ran up against in 14. The right policy is probably consumption based, and especially with moves away from gasoline, especially with people shopping online, your goods still come to you via the roads. So a sales tax would capture a lot of that activity. So it's not that it's a bad idea. It's whether it's politically feasible.
So you advise the House Speaker, and I know you're in the ear of the Senate Majority Leader. What are you telling them about what to do here with the roads?
I'm sorry we didn't fix it. But and that would be too much to say I advise them. I answer their calls when they call. But I do share some lessons learned. I will concede we weren't very public. We didn't talk to you about what we were trying to negotiate in 14 because we were handling that behind closed doors. We were handling
that's the
that
problem. You should have had the media involved.
If MERS had been in the room, it would have been solved without a doubt.
Yeah. That's right. MERS, mediator. What do you agree to? Put it on the record. Well, we could add mediator to our list of services, John.
Absolutely. Why not?
But what they need to do is make sure that people understand their principles, what they're after, what they want to see done. And to that end, I think Speaker Chatfield's been clear. He believes that every tax that's paid at the pump needs to go to fixing the roads. I think Senate Majority Leader Shirky has said we need to make sure that one idea with that is to make sure that the bonding proposal, not new debt, funding for pensions can free up the cash to allow to do that. So he's talked about that publicly. Well, there's a starting point. There's at least two pieces. Now, the missing pieces, though, were what's the money that needs to go to the roads? And then you do the math on what's left and how are we going to get it there?
Okay, you explained how to do it. Now, not to put you on the spot, what's your level of optimism that this will get done in 2020?
I'm eternally optimistic, but in all sincerity, as I watched the budget standoff that happened recently, I thought it a shame because I didn't think it needed to happen. I thought there was a miscalculation by the governor's office of the DNA of Speaker Chatfield and Senate Majority Leader Shirky. There's everything about these two guys that want to solve problems. And I was flip earlier when I said maybe I ought to embrace a credit for stopping a gas tax increase, and politically that probably would be beneficial. But in reality, people who run for these jobs run to solve problems. And so what nags at me that we didn't get the problem solved. And what would nag at these two guys is that if they didn't get it solved. So I think everything about them wants to find a solution. And I think there's a lot of times that in the heat of the debate or in the heat of the struggle here in Lansing, you fail to step back and see what the other side wants and find a solution for that. So I think there was an overreaction in the budget process that didn't need to happen. It was harder to solve than it should have been, but they still have the opportunity to do that, and I believe that they want to.
I'm going to say 30% chance they get this done.
You didn't give us a percentage, did
he? Yeah, I know. So I'm going to give you mine. What is your percentage, John?
Probably 25%.
All right. So we're in the same ballpark. Are we being too pessimistic?
I'm going 63%.
63% that it gets done or doesn't get done?
63% that it does get done.
Okay. What district did he represent, John?
What?
What district did Jace represent?
I don't even
the
remember
63rd.
The 63rd. That's, oh, smart.
What was my margin of victory in 2010? 63. What was our Republican caucus in 2011? 63.
You are Mr. 63.
So when you do the Keno, you always pick 63. That's one of your numbers, right?
It has to be one of the numbers. Absolutely. I even left out what we had a 1963 Ford truck that was our parade vehicle.
Oh, my gosh. All right. So 63%, but it sounds like that's just his lucky number. So
it's in the ballpark. That's the reason I picked 63. But it is in the ballpark. I think it's over 50%.
Other things from 2020. What else are you expecting out of this legislature in 2020? It would seem like the political winds will make this a little less bipartisan than it was in 2019. We could get some abortion legislation from the Citizens Initiative coming in, for example. Guns could come back through these county sanctuary, this county sanctuary idea. What do you think, though?
Yeah, I think there could be those issues that highlight the differences. However, I do think that they'll seek to govern. Again, I think the very DNA of Shirky and Chatfield is that they want to solve problems, so I think they'll seek to do that. I think they'll seek to do that on roads. I think they'll seek to do that on the budget, and I think they'll seek to do that on criminal justice reform. So I think those provide some opportunities for them to deliver real results for Michigan citizens, and they can achieve all of those. The question will be, does everybody listen to each other enough and be open enough to what the other position on that debate needs?
The percentage that Donald Trump is going to get in Michigan can't be 63%.
It's not 63%, but I think it's 60%.
Really?
I do, and I'll confess, I was one who said he couldn't win in Michigan in 2016. But if you go out and you listen to people about what's going on, I think there is a very strong support for him, and I hear a lot of times, boy, I don't like what he says, I don't like how he behaves, but I like what he's doing.
If Trump wins with 60%, the Republicans retake the House.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you odds that he won Michigan.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, how many? The percentage.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It'll be close. It'll be 50.5 to 49.5.
Okay. Yeah. So, but if Trump wins Michigan, the Republicans will retain the House, the state House, don't you think?
Yes, and I think they will. I think the map has changed dramatically. When I was here with the same maps, ironically, there was a lot of claim about how they were drawn so that only somebody could win certain districts. It's totally changed. And so when I was here, I'd say, Oakland County would be one of the first areas we'd put in the proverbial bank, and then it'd be fought out in Macomb and north of Clare. That has, the same map has just changed dramatically. And now north of Clare and Macomb County probably going to the bank first, and it'll be hard fought in suburban areas, Oakland County, down over in Portage, et cetera.
Jace Bolger. And then for our listeners' benefit, just remind our listeners what you're doing right now.
Sure. I work with the West Michigan Policy Forum. I'm policy advisor there.
Do you still have your own private firm as well?
I do, Tusker Strategies. But of course, I'm here on my own accord, or the former title.
Jace Bolger, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks. Good to be here.
Joining us on the other end of the line is Traverse City Attorney Mike Naughton. He's been representing the group that was attempting to recall Larry Inman. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Kyle. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Well, it was a tough week for the recall effort. The Bureau of Elections decided there was not enough valid signatures to proceed with the recall. Is there any steps that the recall committee can take, as far as you can see, to resurrect some signatures through the courts or anything to breathe any life into this?
At this stage, I don't really think so. I mean, there's timelines in place statutorily for the elections to go forward, and so there's not much we can do to get a recall going. But I think we've illuminated some issues legally that could be challenged down the road by this one or another recall down the road.
So as far as the folks in Traverse City now, this has got to be pretty disheartening to have put as many hours as they put into this to gather the signatures needed. This was a very difficult task to get the signatures that they did in a very tight time frame.
Yeah, but, you know, the good thing about it is no one's really hanging their heads up here. What this was about was representation for Grand Traverse County and Traverse City and Lansing. And the people that I've talked to who volunteered and, you know, were out in the streets in the snow and the rain trying to get signatures, they're proud of the work. They're proud that we appealed it. They're proud that the face of recall law has changed a little bit because of the Supreme Court decision. And so people feel like their voices were heard up north. And that's really important. And that's something that, as an attorney, you know, I find gratifying, too. You want to fight for something that you think is a little bit bigger than you. And we feel like that's where we were.
The recall committee here, too, is also plowing new ground in that nobody had challenged or attempted a serious recall effort against the state officials since the law was changed in 2015. How did that change what you guys did, or did you kind of feel like you were pioneers, in a sense, in navigating this new law?
Well, we knew this would be hard coming out. There was never any illusion that this is easy and getting a recall in Michigan is easy. But frankly, it's not supposed to be. When someone gets the privilege of being elected into public office, you don't really want to make it easy to have a trapdoor there to get them out. And so we knew that, but we also felt like we had a shot. And this is a case where the way we structured the recall wasn't necessarily the federal indictment itself, but the missed votes and using opioid addiction as a defense in the public corruption case.
You guys thought that was kind of BS, didn't you? Or the whole opioid thing.
No, I wouldn't say BS. I did a town hall up here and talked about it. And I'm not of the mindset that you should, you know, tout someone's substance abuse issues as like a problem. If Mr. Inman was taking care of it, that's fine. But here's the difference. We're talking about a representative who has a public filing that said, when I was in office, I was doing so many opioids, I didn't know that what I was doing was wrong. That's different. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to really get that to people, that distinction. We weren't saying, hey, you did opioids, you're a bad person. That wasn't it. It was, you said in the court filing that you had a problem with the opioids while you were representing the 104th District. Maybe it's time for you to take care of that. And so it's an important distinction, I think, in a case like this, and especially in Michigan. Opioid addiction is a huge issue and nothing that anyone takes lightly.
Now, in our last podcast episode, we did make the commentary and describing the recall attempt against Larry Inman as the gang that couldn't shoot straight. I imagine you took some umbrage about that characterization.
I did. And I got a lot of respect for you and your publication, and I think that that's where the umbrage comes from. I think Traverse City... It's a growing place. It's a community of choice. People choose to live here and live here year-round. And we really want to be important on the Michigan stage. And it's important to us for people in Lansing, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Marquette, you name it, to recognize that Traverse City's got a voice. And we've got people here that care and that want to do it the right way. And so it was important for me to reach out to you and say, well, it's not that we couldn't shoot straight. There were a lot of moving targets that we were trying to hit.
Any last takeaways here on the recall attempt on Larry Inman that you'd like our listeners to know about?
Well, we appreciate the attention that we've gotten, and we hope we've been able to start a dialogue across the state. We're one of 8 states that have this right to recall, and what's appropriate? What are the confines that a recall should or shouldn't have? And you know, we hope that this is something we've been able to contribute to that conversation.
Mike Naughton, he was the attorney for the attempt to recall Larry Inman. North Coast Legal, is that the name of your firm?
That's right.
All right. Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Join us here in MERS World Headquarters is the president of Launch Michigan, Adam Zemke, joined by the executive director, Lindsay Palsrock, and state representative, Aaron Miller, who's a House Appropriations Committee member. All right, so let's talk about Launch Michigan. Adam, I want to start with you. For our listeners' benefit, this is basically an education reform initiative. How is this different from all the other education reform initiatives that seems like sprout up in this town every year or so?
Thank you, Kyle. The biggest difference with launch from really any other initiative that I can remember when I was a member of the legislature is the people. If you look at the folks who sit on our steering committee, our three co-chairs, Paula Herbert, who's president and CEO of the MEA, Tanya Ellen, who's president and CEO of the Skillman Foundation, and Doug Rothwell, president and CEO of the Business Leaders of Michigan, and then the diversity of our steering committee from an industry standpoint, education, both school labor and management, business associations, and philanthropy. The difference is that historically, these folks either have may not all totally been on the same page or talking together or working together initially, or frankly, could be fighting one another. This is an opportunity. And frankly, I think it's been really impressive as to how long these folks have really spent together to build trust and come together around ideas.
Lindsay, explain then what is the goal then of Launch Michigan? So you've got all these different stakeholders together, business, labor, but what do you hope to achieve? What do you want to see out of this?
Sure. Thanks, Kyle. We're here because of our outcomes in Michigan. And we've sort of looked at a few decades of decline or lack of improvement in Michigan. I think everyone's decided that our siloed approach to fixing this or rapidly improving this is not working. I wouldn't even go so far as to call this as an initiative. I hope this is sort of the new normal in terms of having these type of stakeholders collaborating to really look at a coherent transformation and reimagination of K-12 education delivery in Michigan, and not sort of, you know, the shiny object for 2020 and then what's next.
You guys had kind of laid out a process, I think, last year at one of the events I covered. I think it was the Canuck Policy Conference. Talk to our listeners about where you're at in that process. What comes next? What are the expectations going forward?
We've just unveiled our phase one recommendations. We have a three-phase approach. Phase one is initially, and then phase two over the next 5 years, and phase three over the next 10 years. It really is what Lindsay highlighted. The goal here is for a change in thinking and a change in practice around education in Michigan. And we recognize that in order to do that, you build upon one another. That's why the phases are overlapping. It's not just the next new silver bullet or shiny object, because frankly, we've never been able to realize the success of any silver bullet or shiny object as a result of our approach in Michigan.
Just to add to that quickly, I mean, it was really important to steering committee members that we have what they called a multi-year, multi-phase approach to this that was going to transcend any legislative or executive term limit, that we were here to understand how to look at long-term reform, transformative changes to processes and delivery, and not to sort of watch this pendulum move around and chase one-off solutions depending on who's in control.
Talk about standardized testing. Does this mean that we're going to do a new test instead of MSTEP?
Allude to the fact that we have not commented on assessments in our phase one recommendations. I can tell you that without measuring achievement in Michigan, I don't know how you go somewhere. But there's a lot of very valuable conversations going on around assessments, duplicative assessments, what are assessments used for, which ones, and those are ones that we're having as well. So we have not put out a recommendation on what Michigan should do around assessments or suites of assessments, but it's definitely a topic that we're coalescing around as part of phase two and phase three.
This pushback that we're hearing from the local level, that they're tired of the state government telling them what to do. And I see you nodding your heads, but explain how what you guys are doing at Launch Michigan either goes along with that or runs contrary to that, because they're tired of top-down stuff. They're tired of state government telling them what to do. What does Launch Michigan tell them?
Sure, thanks. I think a lot of this, again, comes down to the people at the table. We've got representation from the field, from our educators, from our superintendents, our principals. They're a central part of Launch Michigan. And my background coming from a business association, you know, it's not that potentially those policies or reform efforts, the wrong ones, but we really lack buy-in. We've come to realize that anything we do without significant buy-in from the field, and our business representatives on the committee are starting to understand this. I mean, they study culture and morale in their organizations. They understand that without employee buy-in, without field buy-in, really we go nowhere. That's a major difference in our approach, is that we're all sitting together. We're looking at creating consistency and providing actually the support behind the policies.
And just to add to that, if you look at the phase one recommendations, you'll see a shift. in practice. And I think historically, what we heard from the field, just to put an example out there, is yes, take your policy, literacy coaches, different assessment reimbursements. It's not that educators in the field don't appreciate some of those things. Not saying they appreciate all of them, but what we're hearing is that some of them are frankly helpful. However, we are in such a state in Michigan that they need the ability to make those decisions and the order of those decisions at the local level because they need the flexibility. And so when you talk to a great example of this is around literacy coaching, valuable experience, high quality coach requirements in state law. But if you have educators who are rotating out of the classroom, the same classroom, multiple times throughout the year, because you have such a dire shortage, then coaching is almost all for naught. You've got to work on those individualized problems first. And that's why if you look at the phase one recommendations, you'll see that the plan is a locally driven plan. It's got some other accountability metrics in it that involve regional and state entities, but it's a locally driven plan. And that's an important difference between what we're talking about and historically is what has been the norm around town here.
All right. So Representative Aaron Miller, before you were a state representative, you were a school teacher, right?
Yes, sir. Yep. Ninth grade.
Ninth grade. You taught history?
I taught mostly math. I taught a little dabbling one semester of social studies, but mostly math. I started out in seventh grade and ended up in ninth grade, so Algebra 1.
You've heard now about this Launch Michigan program. As the chair of the school aid budget, how is what they're talking about something that you might be willing to do in your budget?
Well, I can agree with Adam and Lindsay that we need help. And I think that's probably the first, maybe checkbox number one or checkbox zero, is admitting you need help and admitting that things are not where they should be here in Michigan as far as education goes. And if we can all agree on that, and then, like they said, get some players on board with each other that aren't typically on board with each other, you can start to accomplish some things. How that looks in the end, I'm on board because all I really came in as school aid chair, some people might come into a certain chairmanship with a mission or an axe to grind. I really didn't come in with either. I just want to put together a good education budget for the kids of the state of Michigan. What they're talking about this morning fits in with my goals as far as bettering education and having a locally driven plan for us to get on multi-year and get our scores up, among many other things. Obviously, it's more than just scores. It's about kids graduating and becoming ready for the workforce, and that looks like a million different things. So I can tell you as a teacher, when I came up here to Lansing, one thing that surprised me was how much different educational groups war with each other. And I thought that was unfortunate because we're talking about the education of children. It shouldn't be a war. It should be a team, an exercise. Really, we should be working together to better education. Unfortunately, though, as is inevitable, different education segments disagree on certain things, and hence where we are today. So
it's encouraging to see, let's say, labor and business, at least, on the same page.
Oh, it's encouraging for me. I was surprised to hear the main three chairs when Adam and Lindsay told me, but surprised in a good way, because usually the business groups don't, I'm going to use another term, they don't get together with the unions each and every day. That's not a typical thing here in Lansing. Everybody who's used to policy analysis or covering Lansing in any way is pretty used to that. So when I saw the three chairs, I was pretty surprised in a good way.
Well, and so Adam, someone look at this and say, all right, so this is just a feel-good kind of thing. You get business leaders together and you've got the MEA. They can't come out with anything substantive. They'll just agree on the same things that kids got to learn, and we can all hold hands and bang on the drum for more money. I mean, what can happen here with these different entities getting together?
This is a great question, Kyle, because there are a lot of naysayers around education. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you started off the conversation saying, what makes this different from any other shiny education reform? Because that's what we've seen in Lansing. And the ability is not only in the diversity of the groups in their politics and in their support, but it's also in the people that we've commented a lot on the fact that the individuals who are part of Launch are just as critical as their organizations. Those three individual co-chairs are really rock stars, and what they've done to come together has been remarkable. To counter your point, what we've put out in phase one is pretty substantive. We've said that we want to take a step towards student-centered funding, something that is funding the actual needs of individual students. We've looked at how we can go all in on a pilot almost for K-3 students. We've looked at the correlation between literacy rates and poverty and where it is across the state geographically. And that's one thing you're going to hear us talk more about because it's everywhere. And so the substance behind what we've put into the phase one recommendations, both on the funding side, but also on the leading accountability plan. And I'm going to turn it over to Lindsay because this was almost her baby, to talk more about that.
First of all, if you look at our report carefully, a lot of it looks relatively high level and vague, but there's some statements there that if you read them closely are meaningful. If you remember who's on our steering committee, you know, the fact that we've said we need one single accountability system in Michigan, the fact that we've said we need a central authority that has the ability to intervene in struggling school districts, i.e., you know, whether that's a reimagined, you know, reform office in the Department of Education or whatever that ends up looking like. We've gotten actually a significant amount of consensus after really, you know, studying other states and working through these issues together. But on the leading side, you know, we implement something in Michigan and then, you know, we watch data and a couple years later we say, we haven't seen any major progress. But we've never really be able to put accountability around inputs, right? So to say, new resources, sure, but they're not going to go into a black hole, right? We need to understand what are your research-based practices, how are you going to measure them, what are your local goals, and have a transparent way for average people and lawmakers to be able to follow that and essentially look at our own data set around accountability with inputs and spending.
Will your group at any point or any of the phases address issues and questions surrounding the governance of our education system? I've covered education since 96, and it seems like it's always there's always a lawsuit, or there's a partisan ballot, or there's a battle between the governor and the board. We've reported that, you know, board members are elected largely based on who wins the top of the ticket for these very long terms. Is that something the group will look at?
I am certain that governance at many levels will be discussed. You know, there are many levels of education, and I think we're going to have substantive conversations about what governance should look like at many of those.
Can you talk about where the local input aspect of this falls together? Because supposedly we have these local schools, and they're supposed to some extent reflect what their expectations are. At one time, they were supposed to be the main individuals and the main force that was controlling or at least advising school districts on how they should teach and what they should teach.
Absolutely. So I can tell you that in crafting the recommendations, we spent a considerable amount of time talking with educators. I'm not certain if this is the largest educator survey that's ever been conducted, but it's definitely up there. Launch's educator survey talked with over 17,000 Michigan educators. 14,000 plus were teachers. And the balance were administrators. And so developing the recommendations that we have was very much driven by that local voice. In terms of the actual plan, it's reflected in it, in the desire to have a locally driven strategic spending plan. That we call it a local accountability plan, but that's basically what it is. And allowing that almost partnership between local regional entities and state government on how that whole thing works. And if you look at, although this is different because the partnership model applies exclusively to schools who are really struggling, but the concept between partnership between local, regional, and state entities is actually has some positive precedent in Michigan. And so we look to those things as well.
Representative Miller, you heard Adam talk about student-centered funding. As the chair of the K-12 budget, what does that look like, and is that something you can put in for the 2020 budget?
That touches on the concept that Governor Whitmer really started, that has also been going on in some areas for a while. And that's the idea that obviously all students are not the same, and our funding system currently is set up to reflect that, even though most people would admit that's not true. What that means is with Proposal A, obviously there's a minimum funding per student. I believe it's 8,100 now. I can never remember the number because it changes every year.
And it's never a round number either.
It's never a nice number, no. So there's the minimum out there. Depending on how fast we close that gap from what's called a 2X formula, it could be 4 years away where the maximum and the minimum are then together. Student funding is a complicated thing. That's all to say that. The shift that really began, I think, more earnestly than it ever has in the past is when Governor Whitmer said, we want the dollars to travel to where the needs are. We're going to fund with weights. That was kind of the key word of last budget season. We're going to weight different things at different levels, recognizing that it costs more to fund a special education student or an at-risk student. Obviously, some students are both. We're going to weight transportation costs.
But did you guys do that in your budget?
To a certain level, yes. And there were other things that we could have funded as well. One thing that the governor didn't put money into and said we can take a look at it later was English language learners. And that was something that Senator Schmidt and I said, hey, let's do it now. You can always debate about the amount or the factor that you use on whatever weight, but just recognizing the fact that students cost differently and vastly differently in most cases is step one to putting together a funding scheme that exercises that and that puts it into practice.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, since we have you here, there's been a lot of talk about a supplemental for the current year. And obviously, there were a lot of line items that got axed out of your K through 12 budget. Is there anything in particular that got axed that you're urging the speaker, please put on the negotiating table? I'd really like to see this thing through.
Well, one that comes to mind that I've been able to see that doesn't operate in my area, but I've been able to see its value in other places is Teach for America. That's something that Representative Camilleri was a part of, that Brandi Johnson and the governor's office was a part of.
What is Teach for America?
Teach for America, as best I can sum them up, they're an organization. They're not for profit. They're not out to make money. Instead of looking where there's a dollar to be made in education, Teach for America, in my best estimation, goes to where the real problems are, and goes to where nobody else wants to teach, and says we're going to focus with intensity on these areas, and we're going to put in teachers who want to innovate, who are there not because they're going to make money, but who are there because they want to help, and that's where they go.
So these are actual volunteer teachers, or does Teach for America pay for them, or...?
No, they still get paid.
But whose teachers are they? Are they school districts or are they Teach for America's?
Both.
Oh.
It's an organization that trains their own. And I was told that most of their individuals don't even have education degrees, and that might be a flashpoint for some. But they're going into areas where there might not even be a teacher in that room. There might be a warm body, a substitute or a long-term substitute. So they are trained by Teach for America. But they do work at the school district, and I'm not sure how that setup works. I've only gotten to see them in the classroom. I haven't seen how their books work and everything. But Teach for America, returning back to your question, Kyle, is a program that I don't think anybody in Lansing disagrees with. In fact, if you were going down the list and saying, which program is a Republican program, which program is a Democrat program, let's be honest, these programs, at least Teach for America, are mostly in Dem districts. And they're in Democratic areas. That's not the point. The point is, I think everybody agrees Teach for America should be funded. And that's one that I think should be on the next list for a supplemental. And of course, there are many others. There are also some that I wouldn't mind leaving right there and saying, well, Governor vetoed them. Thank you, Governor Whitmer.
Are you going to tell us which ones that you're talking about?
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. There are many different line items that focused on one particular thing, whether it was a nonprofit or a company. It said, hey, we're going to give you $300,000 or $1 million. And there were some of those that, you know what, they've got educational value, but maybe we could be spending the dollars somewhere else. Those types, I'm not the most thrilled about. I think we could leave that funding setup in the dust and move on. But here's what I say is there are always two sides to every story. And let's say you want to focus on one particular initiative and put a stress on that, then funding it at a certain level for X amount of districts is the way to do it. So it's not a cut and dry debate. But for the most part, I'd like to see money, by and large, go to the foundation grant and go into education. And that was kind of the big debate last year. I'll use one that the governor picked out and put in her press releases repeatedly.
Algebra Nation.
You
yeah,
got it.
Right.
That's one that, for some reason, there's a lot of fiery debate. I was an algebra teacher. Really, what I want to see from any program is, are the results worth that $300,000, $500,000, $600,000? If yes, then we can have a conversation about it. If no, then we should move on and we should use that funding for something else.
Jack?
Yeah, I was going to say, when you first said this area or that area, I wasn't sure whether you're talking about physical geographical areas or you're talking about an area of education, such as history or algebra, et cetera.
Right.
So which did you mean, or did you mean both?
Really both. It could be both. One thing that's in the budget that was quite a conversation when it came to line items was the isolated district funding. Three out of those five districts were in the Speaker's House district. Again, that's something that's not an academic area. That's something that I think everybody would agree, oh man, their transportation costs are huge. We ought to fund them quite a bit extra because they can't merge with the next school district that's 50 miles away. But it also could be something like Algebra Nation, where that's an academic area.
Well, thank you everyone for showing up here today. Aaron Miller, State Representative, Lindsay Palsrock, Executive Director of Launch Michigan, and Adam Zemke, former State Representative and now President of Launch Michigan. Appreciate the time, guys. All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Jace Bolger for coming in a little earlier today, Aaron Miller, State Representative, for also coming in. But the biggest thanks for the day comes to our alum, Emily Lawler, who has just brought us cookies, and not just regular cookies, John. These are cookies that have the MERS logo embroidered on the front in frosting.
I know, and they're awesome, too. They're very tasty.
Emily, why don't you? I'm going to taste the MERS cookie here, and while I'm eating it, why don't you tell us why you are making us cookies, other than you're just a fine human being?
Well, first of all, I love that my return to the MERS Monday podcast is for cookies. I just, you know, I've been waiting for years to be invited back. I think 5 or 6 years, actually.
Is that a hint?
Thank you.
We haven't been on since 5 or 6 years.
No, I haven't been on since I worked here.
How is that possible?
I don't know.
I thought we did the Lawmaker of the Year thing. Well, that was 5 or 6 years ago.
Did you?
I think that was 5 or 6 years ago.
Shit, time flies.
Yes. No, but I am starting a cookie business, and I'm still in the reporting business for MLive, of course. But I'm here because John purchased this lovely batch of cookies, which I was really excited to make. I feel like, you know, if cookie and artistry can be compared, the capital is my muse. So.
Now, Emily, this is not the first time I've had some of your cookies. And I'm surprised it's taken you this long to actually sell them, because they are fantastic. I've always thought they're fantastic, and I've told you you should have been selling them for years.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I feel like when I was with you guys, I was kind of like perfecting a recipe. And then over the last couple of years, you know, my husband calls it stress baking, that I just like come home after a hard day and I'm like, I'm going to make some cookies. So I feel like the recipe's gotten better. So I'm glad I got to bring them back, because I didn't want you guys to like leave with like the impression of my cookies from when I worked here, which was, you know, I was using a little bit different of a recipe at that time. The recipe, frankly, had too much fat in it. I've cut out a little bit of butter and changed the ratios a little bit. No, and these are a lot thicker than the ones that I was bringing you 5 or 6 years ago.
We have red stars here, blue stars here, capital domes. And I gotta say, the cookies are much sweeter than the Lansing rhetoric.
But you do realize you're eating works of art here.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem. Like, I almost didn't want to eat this MERS one because it's so cool looking.
Yeah, you grab it pretty fast, though.
Not good. There's
more.
There's
layers.
So if people want to order some of these bad boys, how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so my website is cookiepress.net. So I'm overly qualified on the press part of that, and getting qualified on the cookie part, too.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, Emily, thanks for bringing these in, and thanks for talking to us about your new cookie experiment, and we're going to have you on a little bit more now that you've told me that.
I was going to say, I look forward to being back someday, Kyle, and I'll bring cookies if that's what it takes.
You know, that's how Andrea Bitely keeps coming on. Because she promises to bake goodies. No, I'm just playing. No, Andrew's great, too. All right. Thank you, Emily. And that's going to do it for this week's edition. Thanks, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malone.
Cookie, cookie, start with C. Yeah! Cookie, 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 start with C. Oh, boy! Cookie, 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 start with C.